you have been doing in Strasbourg. And what I would like to, I would first like to explain to you why I worked on insects. It's all really partly done. Over the last weeks, many people asked me, journalists asked me, why do you work on insects? When you're interested in human health, why not work on humans and not on insects? So I always have to apologize and say, insects, first of all, represent today 80% of all living species in the world. They destroy 1/3 of all human crops, and they put 1/3 of humanity at risk of transmission of viral or parasitic infections. So it's a really important group, and of course, as Murray has said already, I got interested in for zoological reasons by my father when I still was in Luxembourg, and he was an entomologist, was already mentioned. And when I came to Strasbourg University, I went to the laboratory of Pierre Joly, who is shown here. And Joly was, he was an endocrinologist, and they used at that time, they used to transfer glands, endocrine glands from one insect to another to look for the phenotypes for the effects. And he had noticed that never, although he took no precautions of sterility, never any infection appeared in the city. So he said, the insects must be very, very capable of fighting microbial infections. And that was really what got us started in the laboratory at that time. Now, let me show two other summarizing slides. It was known when I started my PhD, it was known for work Meshnikov, everyone is familiar with that, that there was phagocytosis. It was discovered in invertebrates. There was phagocytosis to fend off bacteria, and work by Payot in France and Glass in Germany, which had been totally forgotten for reasons I don't understand, had shown after the First World War that it was also induction of antimicrobial substances. This is Payot. So, again, because we are short in time, I will just simply say, in the laboratory of Professor Pierre Joly, we worked on grasshoppers. So here's a grasshopper, and what I did in my PhD work, and my wife, who later worked with me also on grasshopper antimicrobial defenses, was to look with experimental biology tools, to look at the way these insects were fighting microbes, in fact, invading microbes. We could show that phagocytosis in this insect present very important role. We could not show at that time, we did not find an induced antimicrobial peptides. And to this day, they have not been found in this group. So, we, for other reasons, when our wife defended her PhD, we had invited Hans Bormann to come to Strasbourg for the defense. And he had just at that time, he was working on Hylophora cypropia, which is a moth. And this is Hans Bormann from Stockholm. He passed away a few years ago. And he had identified in the blood of infected butterflies in diaposing pupa, he had identified the peptide, which was an useful peptide. And in this slide, I've shown an experiment which we did in the beginning of when we worked on flies. We started with large blowflies and then went over to Drosophila. So we saw that we could induce very strong, potent antimicrobial activity in the cell-free hemolymph. This is measured by growth inhibition assay. And that this induction, as illustrated here, did not happen, of course, in controls, which then induced us to ask three questions, which will be the core of our presentation. Number one, what is the identity of these molecules? We suspected, after the work of Hans Bormann, I should mention also that my wife went as a postdoc to his laboratory in the early 80s, and so we suspected in the fly there would also be antimicrobial peptides, but nothing had been identified up to that date. The second question, how are the genes encoding those putative peptides controlled? And the third question, how does the insect realize that there is infection going on? And can it discriminate between various types of infecting agents? So this, in essence, are the three questions which we'll address now in the next 30 minutes. And just to give a take-home message here, what we could show is that the site of production, number one, could show that the fly produces antimicrobial peptides, as illustrated here. Diptericin was the first peptide we identified by physicochemical methods. It's anti-gram negative. Tessin and cecropin were identified by homology cloning following the work of Hans Bormann in cecropia. Drosocin was identified by physicochemical method in our group, defense in also, and here mentioned COVID, peace stands for prolin. So the I should say that these molecules are families of molecules. There's several deuterates and so on and so on. Now the take-home message here is, following an immune challenge, the fly produces in the fat body, which is equivalent to the mammalian liver, transcribes a battery of genes which code for potent antimicrobial peptides, some of which are active against fungi, others against gram-positive bacteria, like rifampicin, or against gram-negative bacteria, as shown here. So, there's one molecule missing here, and we'll come back to that in a second. This, again, to summarize, was done by using the growth inhibition assays. Another point which I want to mention here is that the concentration of these molecules in the blood of the fly are extremely high, in the range of 500 micromolar. And this, of course, is a sign that they are not active against the cells of the fly, not cytotoxic, because that high concentration they would be, if they would be in effect if they were. And it's also a problem which came up to us when we started a company to look at the potentials in therapy, human therapy of these molecules, but can discuss that later over a glass of wine at the receptor. So, next step, after showing that this was a very highly inducible system, was that we cloned the deuterocin gene, and we found in the promoter sequences of this gene, we found that there were NF-kappa B response elements, which had been identified a few years earlier by David Montemore and his associates. And NF-kappa B is a very potent inducer of immune response genes and of stress response genes. Now, what we did to show that these sites were mandatory was doing this type of experiment in which we produced reporter lines. This is a transgenic line, this is unchallenged, and this is a fly which has been challenged, and the reporter is seen leg Z. So we see that these are the blood cells spread over the body. We see that we induce strongly the response, and when we mutate these sequences, we fail to induce the response. I should mention here that in parallel, our colleagues in Stockholm, namely Ylva Engström and her associates, found similar results with the cecropin genes, which they had cloned in Drosophila. So this is NF-kappa B in the fly. At that time, it was known through the work of Stewart that there is one NF-kappa. There was one NF-kappa B family member illustrated here. NL stands for nuclear localization signal. REL is the REL homology domain, which is common to all NF-kappa B family members. And this molecule is retained in the cytoplasm by binding to an inhibitor molecule, which goes by the name of cactus, which has this inhibiting anterine domains. Those names refer to phenotypes of mutants which have been generated by Nusslein Follard, and I'll come back to that in a second. So this was the situation in 1992-93 when we organized with Charlie Janeway and Sunji Natori a meeting in Versailles, which we believe was the first meeting on innate immunity. And so let me just point out a few persons whose name you might know. So Charlie Janeway passed away 5 years ago, Sunji Natori, who lives in Tokyo, and Alan Zikovits, who was at that time at Harvard Medical School. Also I want to point out Hans Bohmann, whom I've mentioned already, Michael Sarsloff, who had worked on antimicrobial peptides on frog skin, and Bob Leber at UCLA, who had worked on antimicrobial peptides in various, in rabbits, namely. Then Dan Hochmark from Sweden, and Jean-Marc Reichardt from our group, Daniel Hoffman, my wife, was here, and Ingrid Fein, who was working with Hans Bohmann. Finally, also, I would like to mention the presence of Klaus Scheler from Stockholm at that meeting. So from there on, there were two directions which were taken in the community, in the committee of innate immunity. One was looking at the mode of action of these antimicrobial peptides and exploring the potentials in therapy. The other group, which included us, the other groups were looking at the control of expression of the genes and at recognition of infection. And we were very fortunate at that time that the work of Nusslein Follard on Drosophila axis determination, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1996, had established a cascade of gene products. So she had done unbiased mutagenesis in adult flies, adult females, and she was looking at, she was screening for embryos which would not survive and they would have strange phenotypes, hence the various names which you see here, cactus and dorsal. So dorsal would not have differentiated ventral side, and so on. And here in this embryo,
we see the system that covered the family member dorsal, retained by binding to cactus, and the system becomes activated via the transmission receptor TOL, which is shown here, and TOL itself becomes activated when a signal is given, and that signal is a cleaved form of Spätzlin, which is a polypeptide, and through various serine protease enzymes. I'm not going into detail of this, which is not fully understood today. So the question then was, this system had been shown to be expressed in the adult female and to play a role in early embryonic development for this dorsal axis. So the question we asked, would this be reused later in the immune defense? It was not an obvious question because at that time most of these genes were considered as maternally expressed genes, but we could show that they were expressed later in development, and we could also show that a child immune challenge highly upregulated their expression. So from there on then, we went to ask the question, do the genes of the cascade, which I just turned, Spätzle, TOL, dorsal, Cassel, do they control the challenge-induced expression of diptyosin? So diptyosin was at that time the only peptide which we had cloned in the laboratory, induced antimicrobial peptide. So this is a challenge in looking here, northern plots of the expression of diptyosin wild type, 6 hours of the challenge, and this is in a TOL deficient background. Actually, at that time, it was dorsal mutants which we challenged. This is loading control. And so what this shows you is that 6 hours after the immune challenge, the diptyosin is fully induced in a mutant, which is in the TOL pathway. And normally, if our hypothesis was right, that this cascade would control the expression of antimicrobial peptides, we should not have seen this in action. So something was wrong here, and it took us quite some time to really sort this out. At that time, Bruno Lemaitre joined the laboratory, and in parallel to these studies, Philippe, Jean-Louis Marque, and Charles Hedrew had continued trying to analyze other inducible immune response genes. And this time, instead of looking for with the growth inhibition assay for antibacterial substances, they did proteomic analysis, they did chromatograms, and looking for inducible polypeptides, whatever their function. And they consistently found a very strong induced peak, which was peak 30 in our labeling, and that peak was complex. We could sequence it and turned out to be 4-disulfide-bridge polypeptide, and it took us nearly 1.5 years until we met Bajawi. It was not antibacterial, it was not antiprotease, and really, by a wonderful chance, I could meet and meeting in Stockholm, FAPS meeting where Hans Bohmann had invited me, I could meet someone who's working on plant antimicrobial defenses. And that person was Wilhelm Rocker from Louvain or Leuven University, and he showed an inducible peptide, or I don't remember if it was inducible, I could look that up. It was a peptide from Brassica. And that peptide was antifungal in Brassica, and it looked so much like the peptide which are here on the slide. And so we started collaboration very rapidly. We could show that this peptide here, which is shown as antifungal, potently antifungal, and we named it drosomycin. That's how it's one of the major immune reactants after a challenge. So this also brought into laboratory, which we had not had until then, a very variety of fungi, and it allowed us also to look at antifungal defenses in a more complete way. So we went then back with drosomycin, and this was Bruno who did that work. We went back to look at induction in wild-type flies, drosomycin as diptyosin, and in a TOL deficient background. And in this case, we see clearly that there is no induction. So in other words, drosomycin induction requires an input from the TOL pathway. By that time, for reasons which are a little bit long to explain in the time constraint of this afternoon, we came across another mutation in another mutant fly line in which we have a converse phenotype, which we refer to as IMD, that is to say, diptyosin could not be induced by immune challenge anymore, whereas drosomycin remained induced. Which then led us to propose let me just also illustrate here, this is an example where we look at the cactus deficient
fly, remember Cactus S, encodes the polycarpal at which it retains an F kappa in the cytoplasm. And we see that in this case, in the absence of any immune challenge, drosomycin is spontaneously expressed, nucleosin is not. So this then led us to propose that we have two major pathway. One, which is the reuse of the embryonic Toll pathway, at least a partial reuse of the Toll pathway, and another one which we proposed to be the RB pathway. Also at that time, we had nothing in our hands except for a mutant phenylalanine, and we had not even cloned the gene, the RB gene. That was to come later. So, what was done next was looking at the survival of flies in these backgrounds, and this is an IMD mutant background. So IMD, remember, controls the expression of deuterostin, which is anti-gram negative, so with reason. So in these mutants, we would compromise the survival. And indeed, what you see here is compromised survival in those fly lines, in those IMD mutants, as compared to the wild type. A converse experiment, which was also carried out by Wuhan on the Metam Laboratory, was to look at Aspergillus infection. And here we have, we look at Toll mutants. Wild type are seen here. They end up dying, so Aspergillus will kill those a certain number of days, but in a compromised, in a Toll compromised background, you see that we have very rapid dying off of the flies. So what this tells us then is that we have here two pathways which control the expression of the antimicrobial genes, and this we'll see in a moment of many other genes. But still, the question is, are those the only pathways, are there many others and so on? And if you combine the mutations in the Toll pathway and a mutation in the RB pathway, then the insects will really will not survive, whatever the agent, the microbial agent which you use, bacterial or fungal. So these are really, there's no redundancy, at least no significant redundancy for these pathways in defense against infection. So this is a fly, a Toll deficient fly, which is infected by Aspergillus. And this was the 96 paper to which Murray has referred, which was signed by Bruno Lemaitre, two doctoral students, Ramat Pashat, who is my successor at the Heller Laboratory now, and myself. This appeared, and this was the cover of Cell, and it did really attract a lot of attention. Let me explain to you why. Not only the fly, people were not that interested in the health of flies, but this is the Toll receptor shown here with and compared to CD14 and interleukin 1 receptor. It was known for work of the University Laboratory in Southern California that CD14 could bind LPS through Lucy-Rich repeat domains. But it was GPI anchored, and as the trend goes, if we want to have an immune response, we need to activate NF-kappa-B, as we've seen in the previous slide. On the other hand, the interleukin-1 receptor has immunoglobulin-like domains outside of the cytoplasm, and an intracytoplasmic signaling domain, which is commonly referred to as a tear domain because it's very close to the total intracytoplasmic domain. So these structures were known. Now, what the work which we presented in the paper, which I've indicated now, showed was that at least in one instance in a metazoan, in an animal, nature had chosen to combine these domains which were susceptible to bind to LPS with a signaling domain, which, as shown in this receptor, can activate anything. So this was the reasoning. I mean, this was not a demonstration, of course, and much more work had to be done in our and in many other laboratories in particular to demonstrate that this was really the case. But it was a lead, let me say. It was a lead for us and for our colleagues with whom we were interacting at that time. And so I'm just going to summarize in this slide what has developed over the years. Now Bruce is going to be much more detailed about this. The fly data, community came to know that there are Toll-like receptors in mammals, the innate immune receptors, and they come in two forms, at least in two forms. One is on the cytoplasmic membrane, as shown here, and one is in the endosomes. Now, those in the endosomes bind to RNAs, to nucleotide sequences, whereas those on the cytoplasmic membrane bind to various cell wall components like polysaccharide, famous TLR4, of which Bruce will speak a little bit later, and bacterial lipopeptides, and so on. Now, so these are innate immune receptors, and via various
adaptive proteins which have been worked out in much heat, named by Luke O'Neill, they activate anti-kappa B and also IRFs. I will not speak about IRFs because they are absent from the fly. So they activate anti-kappa B, which then induces immune proteins, namely, as in the fly, antimicrobial peptides. And this is really an essential innate immune response in, response in mammals. And if you take, for instance, a MeDA8 and a TRIF double knockout mouse, it will not survive to microbial infections at the innate immune level before even the adaptive immune response comes into play. And the second effect of anti-kappa B and IRS can be the activation of adaptive immune responses, which is a theme which has been has attracted much attention over the last 10 years, and which is where there are good indications that this is the case, but there are also cases, also situations, where this is not totally, where toll-like receptors are not totally required. Now, let me come back to the fly. So what I've pointed out is that we have activation of toll by a gift form of Spätzle. Now, Spätzle becomes cleaved by a protein cascade. This is in the blood of the fly, and this cascade becomes activated by fungi and by gram-positive bacteria, which we found out later with Dominique Ferrandon in the laboratory. Now, so in other words, toll is not directly a receptor here for bacterial fungal cell wall determinants, but the receptors must be somewhere upstream here, and they activate the proteolytic cascade. Now, at that time, I should also mention, we knew, we're aware from the literature, that there's not only one toll, the one which is in folate work, but there are nine tolls. So there wasn't, at a given moment, there wasn't a hypothesis that as toll was responding to fungi or gram-positive bacteria, the other tolls might respond to gram-negative bacteria, to microbacteria, whatever. So that we spent a lot of time looking into this, and other laboratories did the same, and I would simply conclude that there is no convincing evidence to date that any of the other tolls activates anti-kappa B in response to an interaction with any sort of microbial invaders. They're all involved in development, and they all play significant roles in development, as does toll, but it is uncertain, certainly not demonstrated today, that they play immune functions. Now, what are the receptors then? When we were in this stage of our work, close to the year 2000, there were a certain number of candidate molecules, lectins, for instance, in the genome, genomes have been established. And the way we addressed the question in the laboratory was through unbiased mutagenesis. I should be clear, so far the story of the work on the toll receptor had been done with the mutants which had been generated by Nussan Foller. And it was only in 1995 when Dominique Ferrandon joined our laboratory that we started doing our own mutagenesis screens, and which were later on continued, done in parallel then by Karin Anderson and Louisa Wu in the United States, and later on by several other laboratories. And what Julien Royer found relatively rapidly was that he found this mutation in which infection of gram-positive bacteria was not well survived. We call this a Semmelweis mutation. This is wild type flies. So here there was a compromised survival in the mutation of a molecule which goes with the name, by the name of PGRPSA. I'll say in a minute what it corresponds to. And shortly afterwards, three independent studies, one in our group by, again, Ferrandon Royer, whom I've mentioned already, Catherine Anderson and Sloan Kettering, and Alan Zikovits, with whom we collaborated, and we came independently, we came to similar conclusions. So we found that PGRP-LC is required for resistance to gram-negative bacteria infections. And before I speak about PGRPs, let me just make a point that, again, Dominique Ferrandon in the laboratory for his screens found that a mutation in another gene, and this is the GNBP, which initially was thought was coined for gram-negative bacterial protein, but in fact it's a glucan-binding protein, and here he looks at survival of infection to fungi, and this is Candida, and we see that this is wild-type survival, and here the insect, the survival is compromised in a mutation of the GNBP gene. So in the next slide, I'll tell you what we know, or at least a summary of what we know about PGRPs and GBPs, which are the two receptors of the system. So PGRP stands for peptidoglycan recognition protein, Those proteins were identified in independent cultures, in, again in Stockholm by Hagensteiner, and in Japan by Ashida. They were looking at induction of various effects, not directly antimicrobial peptide synthesis. And so what they found was, and what has later on been worked out, and summarizing your work from various laboratories, including the laboratory of Hans Eisendorf, Texas. So this is synthetic peptide. I mean, it's a synthesis of what you know about peptide. So this would be the sugar chains, and this would be the stem peptides. Now, in gram-positive peptoglycan, lysine is predominant in position 3 in stem peptide, whereas in gram-negative bacteria, it is diaminoglycanic acid, DAP. So this is a very easy way to differentiate between the two types of bacteria. There are exceptions. There are exceptions to this rule, but basically, this would qualify for gram-positive and this for gram-negative. Now, PGRPs, when they have been crystallized and the structure established, have a groove, and this groove is shown here. And in this groove is an ancient amylase domain, and which is present already in bacteriophage. And after during evolution, this has become, in some instances, a recognition domain. And this can, according to the amino acids which are surrounding this groove, can discriminate between lysine peptidoglycan or diaminoglycan. So it's an extremely efficient system where one family of molecules is used to discriminate between gram-positives and gram-negatives. And on the other hand, glucan-binding proteins are shown here. This is work which we've done with Alain Roussel when he was in Auxerre, again Dominique Ferrandon being in charge of this program. And this here, as we see, beta-glucan fixes itself, comes associated with this part of the molecule, and then initiates a reaction, initiates a cascade. So the point here, the important point here is to note that there are only two very simple molecules, peptidoglycan under two forms, and beta-glucans, which act as inducers of the immune response. So it's really very, very narrow repertoire of recognition. And as a result, what happens, so we wrap it on this, PGRP, this is the upstream PGRP which recognizes lysine peptidoglycan. This binds to, activates a cascade of proteases and proteins. Glucan interacts with GBP3, also activates a cascade. And finally, a very interesting result which was obtained by Dominique Ferrandon in the laboratory, and Jean-Marc Panchard, I should say, is that microbial proteases can also induce this cascade here via a dedicated serine protease, which was dubbed persephone in the laboratory. The cascade of the serine proteases have been mostly identified here. The system is relatively well understood. Now, what is not understood, however, is how binding of peptidoglycan to this receptor, or beta-glucan to this receptor, activates the system. So this mechanism still has to be unraveled. Now, on the other hand, gram-negative bacteria interact directly with what I call PGRPLC in the previous slide, which is a transmembrane receptor, will also induce a change here, and that activates the IMD cascade. And here's IMD, which we learned early in 2001. I believe that was with Sylvia Neitz and Philippe Georgel. And that molecule has a depth domain, which is closest to that of mammalian RIP, which stands for TNF, receptor interacting factor. Now, let me turn rapidly now that we have some information about the effector molecules, namely the antimicrobial peptides, that we start recognizing, or we start understanding how recognition occurs. Let me just rapidly go through the signaling cascades. And this is, so there are two signaling cascades, one downstream of Toll and one downstream of IMD, of the IMD pathway. Now, in the case of Toll, we have the Toll receptor, of course, interacts with Cleave the Spetzler, and then activates a complex here, which has the receptor depth complex with the tube molecule and pellet kinase. This is vocative of the iron kinase of the mammalian system. And then, sort of directly, we do not exactly know how this happens. No one knows in the community how this happens, but cactus becomes phosphorylated. Apparently, it's not the pelicanase which does this process, and after phosphorylation, it dissociates, becomes degraded by the proteasome, setting free dorsal, which goes into the nucleus and controls expression of drosomycin, and as we now know, hundreds of genes, most of which are in function. Now, and let me go to the other pathway, the IMD pathway, which is more complex, of which we have more information, This is the receptor. It comes on the free splice isoforms. I have no time to go into that. It interacts with IMD, which is shown here, so the death domain protein, and which then interacts with MAPIV-FAV, which is the equivalent of the mammalian FAV, and then rapidly activates the TACO1 kinase, which is the central NAP3 kinase, which is associated with type 2, which is not important for us this afternoon, but then will act on a signalosome equivalent, which has an equivalent of mammalian IKK gamma or NEMO, equivalent of IKK beta, mammalian IKK beta. And as a result, there will be phosphorylation of the NF-kappa-B family member relish, which was discovered by Dan Hotmar in 1996, which is very evocative of the mammalian P100 and P105. This becomes cleaved then by the action of the caspase, which is the caspase DRAD, which is equivalent to mammalian caspase 8, and then cleaved the relish domain of the P-caspase, which goes into nucleus to control expression of pterosine and of hundreds of other genes. In addition, downstream of TAC1, we have activation of the kinase pathway. This is a complex story, and I've only shown part of what we know now. And I will surprise you to say that what we are working on, right, with two of my closest co-workers, both Japanese, we're working on this pathway because we know that this pathway, from various experiments, this pathway is also involved in response to androgenous ligands. How it really happens, how it occurs, we do not exactly know, but we've got one published example in the mutants on the DNA, and DNA's two mutants, Nagata had shown that, say, mutants which cannot break down DNA in their fetal lysosomes, you have activation of this IMD pathway. So what we have done, and that's just one sentence, over the last 3-4 years, we have done a transcriptome analysis of this 11 canonical numbers, which you see here, and we have come up with 300 identification of 300 proteins which bind to the various members of the cascade. And by RNA interference, we could establish that half of those give phenotype, positive or negative, in reduction of reporter genes here. And what's interesting point is that half of these are conserved in the flying bars with no known function for the time being. So this is something which we are developing in close association with Uspoipec and Sokia. Now, I come now to the summarizing slide. The time goes quickly. And what I would like to show now, and this is really referring to the very kind and nice introduction of Murray, as I'm trying to compare these pathways between the fly and mammals. Now, of course, I mean, when we show this today, no one is surprised anymore, no one shivers looking at these slides. But when we started off in the 60s, we had, of course, no idea at all. We thought we would find something totally different, what was going on in other groups. We thought the insects had developed their own immune system and so on. Now, this is followed by D, this is the LR4, and this is TNF. You know, so, I won't take much time to go through this. Just look at it now. So these are the receptors, and you see TNF is activated by cleaved cytokine. S is, in the case of Toll, is a cytokine which activates. On the other hand, IMD, it will be a microbial cell wall component, PGN, and TLR4, microbial cell wall component. And then rapidly, we have TAC1 present in all these pathways, both in the fly and in mammals. The IKK complex is present in both systems. And it is not, has not been identified here, but this may be a technical problem. So I leave this open. And then we activate, we phosphorylate cactus, or the inhibitory part of the relish, or IKB, and then which rapidly leads to nuclear translocation of NFKB and of expression of immune response genes. This is an extremely efficient system because it's a system which is near everything, everyone is present. All the members are present immediately, so you just need a small click, and then you can have your translocation and gene transcript. And as shown by the genetic experiments of knockdown, either mice for MID88, for instance, of TRIF, or for fly, for MID88 here, or IMD, if you knock them out, you don't have survival against microbial invaders. So these are really essential. And they're very old. Now this, I often was asked the question, when did this appear? So you have it in the fly, you have it in mammals. And then my last two slides, let us address, this is a very classical phylogenetic tree where we have sponges, the bilateria, and the bilateria appear here, the ring the sea urchins and insects, the kinders, and so on. When did the system of Toll appear? We now know much unless it be through genome sequencing and data mining, we now know that holes are present in all groups, in all animal groups. TAC1 is now found in all animal groups, including sea anemone and the sponges. Now, NF-kappa-B is present in all, and the system, say, the strategy of producing antimicrobial peptides is present in all groups. So in other words, we are in the presence of a system which has evolved very early in evolution, probably with multicellularity. This is a probably depends on the text you read, 600 billion or 1 billion years ago. And the important thing, the exciting thing here is to see that, so this would be the sea of innate immune molecules, that we have a certain number of molecules, of modules of molecules, which are common from here to there. They're still present in mammals. They appear in nematostella. And the circuitry of the action in the immune response has been conserved. So you have always one member above the next and so on, into the next. Now, there are major differences here also. I should point out, for instance, important receptors for infection in humans, significant receptors for humans and in nematostella are the knob-like receptors. And those are absent from the fly. So it looks, again, we have no time to go into this, but it looks at every group according to their own agenda of defenses against invading microorganisms has selected from this sea of molecules which appeared very early in evolution of multicellular organisms. Now, one important step was the introduction in fish, in ancient fish, probably around 150 million years, of lymphocyte and then adaptive immunity with the hallmarks of this enormous repertoire and hallmarks of memory and so on. Now, mind you, nevertheless, this appeared in the context of innate immunity, and as I pointed out, innate immunity for us today is still nearly as important as it is for the fly. In addition, once adaptive immunity was there, there was an influence from innate immunity on adaptive immunity, which is under analysis by several groups. So with this, I would like to thank my associates. I will start with my wife, whom you see here. And she started to work with me. She is not in science anymore, but she's at home with us. So that's and Charles Couture was one of my first co-workers, as was Jean-Marc Richard, and we're still together in the laboratory. Jean-Marc, as I mentioned, is not in the laboratory. Jean-Luc Dimarc and Philippe Vullet have done most, together with Charles Couture, most of the work on identification of the antimicrobial peptides. Bruno Lemaître played an essential role in the analysis of the toll mutants in response to antifungal infection and the pathway. Dominique Ferrandon was the one who started in our own laboratory the unbiased mutagenesis, and Julien again worked on various aspects of post-present, post-microorganism interactions. Julien Boyer, who is now in Marseille. Bruno is in Lausanne. Julien Boyer is now in Marseille. Jean-Luc Himmler is developing our studies on antiviral defenses, which I had no time to go into, but very, very interesting results here. And Léa Rivachina has done the work on anti-parasitic defenses in mosquitoes. And she is now half-time in Berlin at the Max Planck Institute, half-time still in Strasbourg. I would also like to acknowledge the work of a whole series of scientists all over the world who are working in this field. Some joints I have been among the pioneers, like the Bohmann Laboratory in Stockholm, in Frankensteiner, and Halpak, Ingrid Fein, and so with Tilpot, and Deva Kimmler, who is in the audience, and in the United States, Katrin Anderson, Kan Shimoto, Steve Fasselman, Tony Stewart, Trevor, Ingrid Silman, and Maniatis, and the Gritz, Natalie Fon, Linda Stewart, Christine Cox, Laura Perrimont, and David Schneider. And in Switzerland, now Bruno Lemaître, François Rivier is now in Lyon, Julien Roy in Marseille, and actually, Garnet is in Finland and in Cambridge. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you, Jules. You kept us right on time. Is there a question or two? Because if not, we can move right ahead and be right on the ball here. You may have an answer. I see you for yes.
And lots of the experiments were infection based. But we now know that flies and all other animals are associated with diverse from non-infectious communities that might even be beneficial. So can you speak a little about how your work and work on the native immune system will change in the future if we take into account these other communities that aren't necessarily bad?
Yes. There are a whole series, you're right about that, a whole series of studies now on the microbiota in the fly. The microorganism can really be deleterious to the gut epithelia. But this normally, as far as I believe it is understood today, this normally happens in a certain number of pathologic conditions, conditions of mutations. So clearly the gut epithelium does produce antimicrobial peptides. They are produced, namely one rosomycin, they're produced downstream of the IMD pathway. And this one aspect which is very influential in the sense of the reactive oxygen intermediate. Also stem cells in the gut epithelium which allow for the renewal of this epithelium when it once it is damaged. That's basically what I could answer at this stage. We're not that, this is, yeah, okay.
I know I don't have a lot about insects, but my question is that very costly to kill a bacteria by the innate immune response compared to the adaptive?
I wouldn't know how to answer that. So, I mean, the cost, the energetic cost of producing antimicrobial peptides versus adaptive immunity, I would guess that producing antimicrobial peptides with a lifetime, which is, rosomycin stays on for weeks in the blood, rosomycin, it's a co-organism. I would guess that producing antimicrobial peptides is less costly than adaptive immune system, but maybe other friends, it's very difficult to
so ask. I mean the dose response of bacteria is very, very obvious in fly or not.
The dose response, you mean, for the various peptides, it's in the micromolar range, as I said, yes. That means that you can produce a large amount of molecules, if that's what you're pointing out.
Yeah, but because I'm very curious, kill one bacteria are very equivalent to kill a million or just have a
no, million. No, so it is not, how they say in the UK, it's not a kiss and kill mechanism. For deuterocin, we have calculated a given amount that it takes about 1 million of deuterocin molecules to kill a bacteria, you see? So that's in that sense it is very costly, you're right. And that was also a negative aspect for us when we wanted to explore the potentials in human therapy. Because you need large amounts of molecules, and that's excreted very rapidly in the kidney. It was too costly.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Murray. Really a pleasure to be here with family, metaphorical family and real family. And I'm going to speak very briefly today about our work of some years ago, first in isolating TNF and finding it to have inflammatory properties. I'll tell again very briefly how that set the basis for us to identify the receptor for mammalian receptor for lipopolysaccharide. And then I want to tell you about some more recent work where we've used mutagenesis in mouse to create familiar disease phenotypes, and specifically I'll talk about inflammatory bowel disease, what we've been able to learn about pathogenesis by using the mouse and genetics in an unbiased fashion. And I'll close with some considerations about how far we've gone towards saturating the genome, and just how much we know, or how much we believe we know as a result of our work so far. That's easier. Yes. The roots of understanding microbe sensing in mammals are very deep. They go back to the 19th century, certainly, and to the early days after the discovery that infection was caused by microbes, and that we can attribute foremost to Pasteur and to Koch. And immediately after that became clear, people began to wonder, how is it that we discriminate self from non-self? How is it that we recognize a microbial infection when it occurs?